Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'm thrilled to be here, by the way. I was born in South India in a small temple town that is bordered by rivers, making it an island. And I lived there and near Delhi for about 5 years before coming to the States. My father was studying statistics in Cincinnati, and then he followed his professor to St. Louis. And St. Louis is where my mother and I went to join him. What was supposed to be just a visit, we left my brother, who was very young at the time, in India. But we didn't go back, actually, for 4 years. We wound up moving to Rockland County, which is near New York City, and we stayed there until 1970 and returned, got my brother. And I mention this because really themes of displacement and immigration and assimilation are the ones I return to a lot in my work in various forms. I went to a public high school in the suburbs, but I spent my first college year in Madras or Chennai at an all-women's Catholic university. It wasn't my first choice, but my poor parents were not crazy about sending me to an American college because they thought that I would come home with many Western ideas and possibly pregnant, I believe. And so they wanted to play it safe and send me to India. And I also wasn't quite a genius as my brother was, so India seemed very reasonable. But I wanted to major in English. I wound up at studying fine arts for a year, which was the more deviant discipline in the college. You could wear sleeveless blouses. And the president of the college had no hope that I would succeed, and she proved correct. After a year, I developed so many allergies and illnesses, I returned to college in the same area code as our home in New York. And there, my teachers encouraged my writing, as they had also my teachers in grade school. And after going to India, I realized I could really write fluently about South Indian custom. My first story was about a street psychic with a fortune-telling parrot, and I think both the parrot and the psychic died, and I think that's all that I remember. But I also developed in college the germ stories of what would become my first two novels. Grace Paley said famously, "There is a long time in me between knowing and telling." And I believe that's true, and it was true for me. My first book was completed when I was in my late 20s, but having Knopf accept my book threw me in a tailspin. I was also smoking a lot of pot at the time, and I thought I'd written something so transgressive that I would invoke the wrath of not only my family, but all of India. And I sat on the project for about 2 years, at which point the fatwa on Salman Rushdie had been issued. A group of writers from Penn in New York rallied to support him that year, and I couldn't attend. But I did come out of this funk that I was in about writing and being Indian, and I handed in my book. It's a very, very mild book, so there was nothing to fear, but of course I didn't know that. I began the second one almost immediately after the first was done, but it would take me about 10 years to complete it. I started traveling, which is teaching, as you've heard, in a lot of places. And I often taught in resort areas, and I didn't know they were resort areas until I got there and discovered, oh, there's an ocean. This is really, oh, I'm teaching in the Hamptons, not in Long Island. But it was fun. It was my way of discovering the United States beyond the suburbs of New York, which is where I thought I would end up in New York. Knopf took the second book, excuse me, I accepted a long-term teaching job. And I already told you the jokes that I have written down here about that job, so I will skip over those. Three students in Long Island gave me some notebooks, and I had said that I really liked like pale green tinted college ruled notebooks to write in, and they excuse me, they gave me three steno pads, and I started to write after a very long time of not writing. And what I began was this long, torturous novel called Marriage Death, which wasn't exactly happy. And I decided to leave teaching and move to Boulder with no job in hand, Boulder, Colorado. And the book came with me. I tortured it some more until I extracted about four sentences about a very tall woman named Metterling and a very short man that she marries. And in Boulder, in my first 3 years, I wrote about 50 pages of this new thing. Then 2 years passed where I wrote nothing. I took time off from teaching, which I'd never really stopped doing. And my sister-in-law and my brother took me on a trip to India. And on my return, I did three things. I joined Facebook. I started a blog. I thought, oh, let me do that. And I began to write again. And again, the words started to flow. And the novel took shape. I rewrote and revised for about 2 years. And knowing that my teaching contract was ending, I entered a lottery for a three-year affordable housing program. For former fellows of the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Cape Cod. And I handed in the book, which was called As Sweet as Honey. And my name was drawn first in the lottery, and I found myself sort of half-heartedly leaving Colorado because I just fell in love with the state, which is why I moved here. And Two weeks after I left, the book got accepted, so I was very happy to go to a new place with some good fortune. It doesn't solve life's problems, writing a book, publishing a book. It presents new ones, and maybe it urges one to continue figuring things out on the stage, things about immigration, displacement, and assimilation. And I'm really grateful for my time in Colorado, so I'm very happy to be here in Denver. At the Tattered Cover, which obviously loves books. And I can only think that that's a very good thing indeed. So I'm going to share a little bit of this book with you. The book is structured after Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, and it starts with a little line from it, which goes, love is love has a thousand shapes. And I'm borrowing my friend's copy of the book because I actually traded mine for lunch today in Boulder. the restaurant owner wanted to buy it off of me, and I said, no, I can't sell it to you, but I can give it to you. And so he said, okay, well, let me make you something. So he did, off the menu. My aunt Metterling stood over 6 feet tall, a giantess, a tree. From her limbs came large hands, which always held a shower of snacks for us children. We could place two of our feet in one of her sandals, and her green shawl made for a roof to cover our play forts. We loved Metterling because she was so devotedly freakish, because she reined everyone with affection, and because we felt that anyone that tall had to be supernaturally gifted. No one actually said she was a ghost or a saint or a witch, but we watched for signs nevertheless. She knew we suspected her of tricks, for she often smiled at us and displayed sleight of hand, pulling coins and shells out of thin air. But that, said Rossi, didn't prove anything. Rossi had read the Puffin Book of Magic Tricks and pretty much knew them all and was not so easily impressed. What was interesting and never expected was that Aunt Metterling married the littlest man she knew. He was 4 feet 7, dapper and jolly. The grown-ups were embarrassed and affronted, for like Auntie Sita said, it was bad enough having a freakishly tall woman in the family. Yet they were all relieved that Aunt Medderling found Uncle Archer and he her. The wedding was a small enough affair, as weddings go, but the bridegroom did ride to town in a white baby Aston Martin, decked with garlands of roses and basil. The first marriage rites took place at dawn. Someone said how sad it was that Medderling's parents could not be at the wedding, but then neither could Uncle Archer's. I wondered what Medderling's father had been like. He had named her, after all. Who had he been? A man smitten with the German language, it seemed, for her name sounded German, and smitten, too, with his family. A man who died with his beloved wife in a car accident all those years ago. A man who loved his daughter enough to name her something special. A man who must be still alive in Medderling's heart, I thought. And her mother? A small, sweet woman who must have loved her daughter, even as she must have seen something in her that marked her for a fragile future. Also absent, also loved, also missing the wedding. I could comprehend Medderling's longing for her family, because my own father and mother were in America, land of dream and snow. But to lose a mother and a father, no, that was impossible. I could not imagine something like that. I rubbed the sleep out of my eyes, straining to see if my aunt would change somehow after the fire ceremony, the part where she walked 7 steps hand in hand with Uncle Archer. But she kept her eyes downcast, as became a modest bride, while the priests chanted all around her. She wore a reddish pinkish gold sari from Kanchi, with 12 inches of gold jari on its border and 36 on the pallu. She had mained on her hands and feet, aglow from a bath of turmeric and sandal. In her hair was jasmine and rose and tulsi. She wore an engagement ring, and during the ceremony she'd get a gold ring on her 3rd finger, left hand, and a ring on her toe. Uncle Archer would get a ring as well. He wore a white pajama suit of heavy material all the way from Bombay, a pink tie, a boutonniere, and sandals. That he was wearing a suit instead of a formal dhoti was radical enough, whispered the aunts, but to hold hands before the ceremony was too much. We knew something was afoot, but we were not quite sure what the problem was. He's being intimate, giggled Sanjay, stamping his feet, while Rossi and I pretended not to know him. We shook our heads like our aunts did. We were smart enough to know that rules were being broken left and right, and we didn't need Sanjay to tell us, even though it appeared he knew more than we did. Afterwards, Aunt Pa said that she had a funny feeling in her heart that something was not right. But at that moment, when they were simply standing at the ceremony and later at the reception, everything was fine and there was plenty to drink and eat and toast the couple's happiness. He was now our uncle. Auntie Pai smiled and playfully tugged Sanjay's hair. But no one could have predicted what happened next. 1 minute, Uncle Archer was laughing and dancing with the littlest cousins, and then he took Medderling out on the dance floor. She had gone to Western dance classes just for this moment. No one doubted Uncle could dance. He was born to wear a suit and tails. In fact, he bore more than a striking resemblance to the Monopoly Man, with a full white mustache and a round tummy. A Western waltz was struck up and everyone left the dance floor. Some of the elders among the guests frowned and turned away because touch dancing was severely looked down upon, even though we lived in a town. As my grandmother would say, this was not Delhi, not Bombay, but Madhapur, a town on the island of Pai in the Bay of Bengal, a place as sweet as honey where people lived decent lives. Touching was meant for procreation, nothing else. Once we had looked up procreation in the animal encyclopedia, but didn't learn much except about the mating habits of the stickleback fish. But there she was. Aunt Maeterlinck, swathed in gold tissue silk, and there he was, monocled and marvelous, and the music from the hired band began. One turn, two, three, and he was down. Uncle Archer was on the ground. A flurry of activity, then a scream, and we children were pushed aside. The youngest of us didn't understand, but started to cry anyway. Rossi, Sanjay, and I really didn't understand either. When it was all over, no one had any appetite for the plates of round halva and sugared grapes. We were stunned into silence. We had not been paying attention. We never would have believed it if someone had told us. We grew still with shock. We were 11, 9, and 10, plus all of us other cousins, all of us kids. It was the worst thing we had seen or nearly seen. He had died in an instant. There was not even a chance to see exactly where he measured up, someone said in a half giggle or a cry, whether to her knee. That's silly, said Rossi, her elbow, her chin. In truth, some of the guests hardly knew him and had only seen him once or twice and mostly from afar. And it was hard for us to see much during all of the ceremony because Sanjay started chasing Money, who had swiped his spin top, and Rossi joined in to help Money, and she dragged me with her. Mary Angel from two doors down called us to share her caramels. We forgot all about Money and Sanjay as we ate the candy. Rossi said she had to avoid her school teacher then. She did not look so menacing to me when I saw her, a perfectly nice woman with her husband who smiled broadly, making me think that Rossi hadn't done some schoolwork or had skipped out on a class. All in all, we hardly saw them wed. But their love was palpable, like a color that was visible, almost heard. Their arms reached for each other with the sweetest sigh, fingertips touching, swish of gold, monocle flash, one step, two step, three, gone. Maeterlinck sobbed in a corner. She sat right down, 3 feet of her against the wall, another three and more stretched out on the floor. Her crying was fraught and unabashed, and no one seemed to know what to do. No one had ever seen her cry, because her height made her seem protected from whatever ill might befall ordinary women. Grandmother, no slouch, sharply spoke to anyone who said, "It's too bad," and gave them work to do. The other aunties crowded around. Some, you know, were waiting for a moment like this because Maeterlinck, that awkward fish, had landed a man before they did. But others, like Nalini, just burst into tears for the loss and the grief. The marriage hall quickly cleared, and they took Uncle Archer's body away. Uncle Darshan and Uncle Thakur ushered Aunt Maeterlinck out. I looked back at the decorated hall, the garlands of pink, white, and orange flowers trailing from the ceiling and those crushed on the floor. A funny feeling filled my stomach as I stared at the trampled blooms. A handful of cooks and cleaners began to sweep up the food and clear, while a priest continued to pray, and there was a loud murmur of voices all once more as we exited all at once. Outside, the musicians bowed their hands to our grandmother, offering condolences. We gathered on the veranda that evening, not sure what to do. In an instant, our house had gone from celebration to mourning. The family doctor had been a guest, and now she was in charge of the body. Was it a heart attack, an attack on the brain? All we heard was Maeterlinck's muffled crying, which made Auntie Pa want to have us stay with neighbors, but my grandmother decided we should stay home and not cause trouble. There's a bit of a family tree, which I'm going to skip, and I'll just continue with the second chapter. We had heard snatches of their story before, how Maeterlinck and Archer met at a party thrown for a local Nawab minutes before Maeterlinck was to leave to go home. A Cinderella story, only they didn't live happily ever after, and no glass slipper. Instead, Archer and Maeterlinck spoke, captured each other's hearts without intending to, and went home determined to meet again. "He wore funny socks," said Maeterlinck. "Imagine wearing socks in this heat." Maeterlinck had worn yellow and looked like a radiant flower, said Grandmother. They met at the train station next, where they nodded hello, and Archer asked Maeterlinck to another party. This was a more awkward situation because Maeterlinck was, despite her height and name, a proper girl of specific caste and region, and Archer was an unknown. Marry an unknown to a known, and who knows what the net result might be. But marriage wasn't in anyone's head. Merely social edification. So Maeterlinck was sent to the party, a reception, it turned out, for one of our neighbors who came back to from the States with a degree. The grumbling was minimal, more or less, but two chaperones were provided just in case. Maeterlinck was 28, too old already, according to our standards, and as such was ripe to marry a fat 50-year-old from a neighboring town. Mr. Govinda, but as fate would have it, she fell in love with Uncle Archer, who was only Archer at the time, fat enough himself and close to 40. At the second party, the hostess decided on a theme of jellyfish to honor the local marine biologist and served vegetable cutlets with ketchup and multicolored badushas. Maeterlinck stood in front of a punch bowl full of seashells and looked for something to drink. Archer offered her a cup of something sea green, tasting a little like a little of this, a little of that, with the tiniest kick thrown in between. Vodka, she wondered out loud. He shook his head, saying 7-Up with food color. Maeterlinck had never tasted such a fizzy drink before and immediately burped. Archer let one out, too, to save her embarrassment, and that's how their fate was sealed. They decided to go outside to see the roses. Mrs. Mohan's roses were famed all over the district. It was rumored she ordered them direct from England. They were large, immensely fragrant, and individually named. Maeterlinck smiled. How complicated it must be to live here as a foreigner, she said. How hard do you think it is to grow roses, he asked in reply. Riddles, they both thought, feeling awkward. Then Archer looked away a bit. Then he held her gaze. She felt embarrassed and wondered if anyone could see. Who was this man, anyway? A footfall prevented intimate conversation, and they went inside. In the American films we are not allowed to see, couples fall in love at first sight. In fact, they did in Hindi films, too. One of my grandfather's friends fell in love when he saw a girl on a bus and married her within a week. My aunt did not fall in love with Uncle Archer so quickly. She said he made her laugh, but she could not take him seriously at first. In fact, only when the entire family had fallen in love with him could she entertain the notion of marriage. He was easy to love. He came to our house bearing small, funny gifts and flirted outrageously with our grandmother and Auntie Pa. He complimented them on their saris, spoke knowledgeably about market prices for potatoes and string beans, and knew the words to old filmy songs. He made them smile. He was more reserved with Uncle Darshan, but only in the beginning. Soon he was cheerfully playing and losing game after game of Parcheesi and cards, and sometimes he and Uncle Darshan retired with glasses of gin. He gave us a clock shaped like a cat, whose tail swung to and fro and could open and close its eyes. We were delighted. We had a grandfather clock that grandfather received as a gift from one of his clients, but this plastic clock seemed to represent a new age, a new era. He gave us a set of Russian nested dolls and a set of miniature sports cars. "Put a tiger in your tank," said one, which didn't make any sense, but we loved it anyway. He pulled our braids, tussled Sanjay's hair. He taught us to improve our badminton. He told us jokes that made us crack up. He reminded me of a cuddly old teddy bear, eager to please and a bit beaten up. When he came to the house one evening to ask our grandmother if he could marry her eldest granddaughter, grandmother did not hesitate too much. My grandfather had known his father, the gin king, and had often played cards with him into the wee hours. When they first met the gin king, she thought the foreigner was a bad influence on the neighborhood and on her husband. My grandfather said no, the man was only lonely, missing his family, who were in England. Because she remembered grandfather's good opinion of the Jin King, he gave her approval. Sorry, she gave her approval for Maeterlinck to wed. She worried only what people would say. Marriage crossed color lines, not counting religious and cultural lines, was unusual but not unheard of, even on Pi. She wanted to be sure Maeterlinck was certain about Archer, not resigned to any marriage instead of no marriage. If he had been island or Indian, this question would not have even arisen. Our aunt must have reassured her because a date was set for late September. I was glad Uncle Archer's parents were spared his death. Grandmother herself had seen the death of three of her children as adults. Maeterlinck's father, Nalini's mother, and Sanjay's mother. Even one was too many, and there are people in the city who say my grandfather died of grief. I know that the death of a child is the very worst thing that can happen to a parent. My grandmother's face was lined, soft, stoic as well. She could be cross with his exasperation, and her voice could turn querulous. Maybe she knew more than we did that life wasn't to be wasted over petty things. But how does one separate petty from what is important if what is petty seems important at the time? Whenever we fought, it was always over something of importance. When we were punished for fighting, our toys being taken away or having to write out the times table, we sometimes forgot what we fought about. I never saw my grandmother cry. I wondered if she cried in bed like I did. We used to take turns sleeping with grandmother, or we'd all tumble into bed with her. Her body was so comforting, a big mound gently breathing. She smelled good, too, not like powder and perfume like some of the overseas aunties, but of chapati dough, white silk saris hung out to dry, sometimes vetiver. The fan circled above, and the night shine came in through the windows. Sanjay, Rossi, and I believed that if we slept with grandmother, mosquitoes would not bite us at night. Look, we'd say, showing off our smooth arms and legs in the morning. No bites. And it continues. Thank you. I would love, this is my favorite part, I guess, everyone's writer's favorite part, to be asked questions. So if you have any questions, I'd love to hear them. I'll try to answer them.
So does it help to read the other two books first before reading this one?
No.
Yeah.
They all take place in the same island, which I invented. But, thank you. But but they don't. But that was a good question to ask, whether or not each of the books are standalone or the other two need to be first read first. I have to repeat the question. That was my awkward way of doing it.
Well, then what's next?
What's next? Well, I had a lot of fun writing this. I liked the characters a lot. And I wanted to go back to them and maybe tell a story that is important in my family. It's a sad story, but it's... And in a way, I've been writing that story for... a long time in my other works, but my mother's eldest sister died during an emergency cesarean, and it was the large tragedy in her family's life, completely unexpected. My cousin lived, and I was born 2 months after, and I was supposed to be born in the same hospital, and my aunt, she was really excited to have the birth not at home, but in a hospital at the time in Delhi. And she told my mother, you must do this because it's so clean. It's so, you know, the nurses are very attentive. And it was just really bad luck. So So I wanted to always tell that story, and I was also didn't want to really hurt anyone in the process. And she had two children, her oldest has a daughter who just recently gave birth, and my aunt's granddaughter wants to know the story too of her grandmother, who she never knew, and I never knew her, and so we're going to try to tell the story, but in fiction, and I don't know how it'll be, but I've started it a little. Thank you. Rachel. I was asked to tell a little bit about the Island of Pi, where it was based, and where the idea came from. I was in graduate school back in 1983, I think, and I loved The Tempest. It's one of my favorite plays. I can read it again and again. And what I especially loved about The Tempest was that people could come to this setting, which was an island, and leave transformed by their experience. And I wanted to do something like that. And I also did it for a very fearful reason. I didn't want to set anything in India, because what did I know of India? I had spent a year in college there, and I had gone back when I was 10. And I was born there, but my knowledge wasn't intimate. So I thought that by inventing an island that was close to India could allow me to incorporate both Western and South Asian cultures and mix it up and make up my own rules. So that, for instance, in one of my books, a 15-year-old girl can go very happily and have, you know, Coca-Cola with someone who's 30 years old and a hippie, and no one would notice, which of course would not happen, you know, in India, I think, back then, with, you know, in a small town, without someone reporting back and saying. So that's how it came about. And I called it Prospero's Island, and I called it Pi because my dad is a mathematician, and he loves the, he would always ask us about whether or not we could recite all the places of Pi. I mean, I couldn't, but, you know, yes.
This is sort of an off the wall question, but it seems so synchronous that the life of
It's like the zeitgeist or something. Yeah. I have to admit, my heart sank a little when I first heard about the island of the Life of Pi by Jan Martel. And I was just asked this question about, it's an interesting coincidence or something. And I always say, well, that's why I like very discreetly mentioned the fact that I invented it in 1984. But I think that, you know, one of the things South Asia is known for is Ramanujan, and who's a mathematician. And I think that, this man was a savant, and he went to England, and he actually wound up dying. He caught pneumonia, if I'm not mistaken. I probably am. But I think so maybe there was that, so maybe that was it. But my favorite story about the Life of Pi is the fact that Pondicherry, which is a town in South India, didn't have a zoo before the novel came out. But so many people asked, where is the zoo, that they built a zoo. So I thought that was terrific. But yeah. So, but yeah. Cynthia. Yeah. The question was about focusing on why later in the book, in the England portion, Maeterlinck chooses to celebrate Diwali. And when I first moved to the United States, Diwali was the big, we always learned it as the festival that all of India celebrates. And so it was like the one festival that didn't have regional boundaries. That wasn't quite true, but it's how we learned it. And so it was a way of saying, well, Diwali is like Christmas and Hanukkah, and it's a festival of lights. The story that we heard was the version where a king had acquired so much power and strength because of his devotion to one of the gods that he became powerful and power mad and started to pillage and rape 16,000 women, actually, as well, you know, he just made life horrific. And so the smaller gods, the lesser gods, went to ask the larger god, Vishnu, whether, you know, anything could be done, let's say Vishnu. And he was defeated. And when he was finally killed by an avatar or a version of Vishnu or Shiva, he renounced his madness and said, "My death should be celebrated. So everyone should light candles and lights, not candles, but lights." And I love that. I love the idea that, you know, that in this hour of death, there's a sense of, let me redeem myself for the rest of the world who I've destroyed. The 16 virgins who he raped wound up being part of Krishna's harem, I think, and they became sages. This is one story. There are other stories, many other stories. But that's one story. And I wanted to choose Diwali because she's a young bride and she's in England. And it's an important celebration in your first marriage. Sorry, your first celebration. This will not be podcast. Oh, my God. I wanted her to, it's an important celebration to have the first Diwali with her husband. But she's also in mourning for Archer. So it's hard. But she does it, and it gives her something to do, which she needed at the time. It's kind of fun.
Obviously, we know you're right. But then you went to India, and they discouraged you writing the nuns? Was it the nuns?
Well, it just happened to be a very strict school. And whenever you have a strict school, you have a lot of people who rebel. Me, no. I was the most conservative because I came... No, because I came from immigrant parents, and immigrant parents are always more conservative than their compatriots, you know, than their peers in India, because people who are from the mother country move with the times, right? So The nuns didn't discourage me. They were great. I just didn't want to study English. I thought that I knew so much already about literature that what they were teaching, you have to declare your major immediately. And I thought that what they were teaching, I was beyond. And so the teacher, the sister, she asked me to give a presentation on The Spectator or something, which I had not studied. I had no idea. And obviously, I didn't know anything about literature in the way that I thought I did. But I wound up very happily, I wound up leaving literature for fine arts. And that was great because I studied art history. And we did painting. I wasn't very good at painting, but I liked art history. So they didn't discourage it, but I didn't do creative writing then. Then suddenly, because I'd always liked to write, and I think I was so surprised that I was going to India that I didn't know what to do. But as soon as I came back here, I read Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior, and it was the first book where I saw a woman who, in that novel, it's about a young girl who's Chinese growing up in America, but who also has these moments where she jumps into mythology. And there's been a lot of controversy over that, but it made me realize that, oh, I can talk about the Indian mythology, which I loved from Hinduism, as well as write about, you know, realistic contemporary life. Yeah. Do I ever think about moving to India to live a life, to explore some of the themes, to write? Yes, I think it would be wonderful. I think it would be nice to do it in a place where I could. There are actually some colonies and places where you can go and spend, I think, a few months, and like a writer's colony. And I think that would be fun. That would be great fun. Yeah, I didn't used to want to do it, but now I'm more interested. Yeah, I think.
But you would have to identify what things you were allergic to.
My mother always thought that I was psychosomatic about all those illnesses. But yes, I would have to encounter. But I went to India a few years ago, and I really loved it. It's funny because I spent a lot of the time in interiors, you know, in the homes of my relatives, and I wasn't outside as much. One of my favorite times back in 78 was doing a temple tour of Mysore and Bangalore. And I really liked that because it was a lot of architecture and away from the city. So I think that's what I'd like to do, actually, is like do a lot more sightseeing in some senses. Yeah. It's a funny thing not to know India and yet to sort of like write about South Asian culture in the way that I know it, and also know that there are these, you know, there are some wonderful writers who are living in both worlds, going back and forth, and using that to write. So, yes.
I don't quite have the question, but the going back and forth seems to me Indians do a lot of that, but not all Indians do it. So, if you are one who's going back and forth, do you find your people? The ones who are going back and forth, do you fit in more with them than the ones who stay in one place or the other? Like Indians who come to the U.S. and don't go back, or Indians who never leave India, are those groups very different from those who are going back and forth a lot?
That's a great question, actually. Yeah. Is there a difference between immigrants who travel back and forth between the mother country and immigrants who don't? Yeah, it's a funny question because sometimes, as I said before, you can be an immigrant and be much more closed-minded about life moving forward, because you're so nostalgic, you're always in the imaginary homeland, which Rushdie wrote about. It doesn't exist because it's the past. And the people who go back and forth, they are, well, they're global, you know, which has its own sorts of problems, because in a sense, they don't fit in either world. And it's this, you know, where does home? And I think that's the crucial question. For me, I don't know. That's a really good question. When I spoke to my friend, Rachel, who's here, and I said, oh, I'm going to India on a trip. And I said, yeah, it'll be nice to go home. And I said it without thinking. And we both sort of, you know, took a pause. So I'm surprised that I would call India home without knowing it. But I have family there. I don't have my grandparents anymore, but which was a big thing. But I do, yeah. And I've traveled around a lot. So I think sometimes I wonder if it's not the place I write that's home.
Oh,
my family, they're really supportive, and they like this one. Yeah. They're good. They like it published, too. That was a big relief. Big relief. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful. Yay.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.